Okay, but what I showed you is a Meredith source. And there's more there. You have to find it with Rav Moshe and the sunset. You'll understand what I'm saying. And that whole chapter, the Rav deals with the blueprint of the world. You'll understand. If you call me at home, I have it in front of me from my book. You understand? So there I can give you the exact sources, but it's not. It shouldn't be so hard to find. 566-0941 after 9 tonight. 0941. Okay. Gentlemen, and all my dear students, first of all, happy to see you. Secondly, since I saw you last, I'm worth another $1 million at least. And Baruch Hashem. I don't have time. Not a Chassidic Rebbe, I got to teach. Neria. But Friday night, I said a whole pilpul on that niggin. And it's amazing how ignorant people are today. I see that you don't have to be too bright to be a genius today. This is my conclusion. It's just amazing how ignorant B'nai Torah are today. So I said a whole pilpul on that niggin. When it was written, how it was written, the whole background. Now, onto a topic which is unbelievable. First of all, I want to say that I happened to look at the book on Rav Moshe today. Something I needed for my lectures in America. I wanted to be sure I have the 11 signatories to the Chayrim against the Synagogue Council. So I was looking through the book just to see if it lists all 11, but it didn't list. But I know who the 11 are. I wrote it out from my own memory. Nevertheless, while looking through the book, I saw Rav Henkin's picture. And again, it brings to mind the person who was heads and shoulders above the crowd. I think back to Rav Palev's funeral, as I mentioned in class. And by that time already, the right-wing world didn't enter YU. All right, I'm not here to argue with the right-wing world, whatever it is, do enter, not enter. But a man died, a Slutsko, who was Mabitz Torah, 46 years, was one of the greatest Rebbeim in Yeshiva University students. Three generations of students. He had grandchildren of the grandfathers he taught. So, and everyone loved Rav Palev. And give covered, but Rav Henkin came, Rav Henkin spoke. Rav Henkin was so above any little partisan politics. In his halachic writings, he's very unique. He's an individual. He's individualistic. That's what we have to say about him. Or you might want to call him a maverick. If I can use that term, when Aaron Reichel writes about his grandfather, Herbert S. Goldstein, we'll come back to Rabbi Goldstein later today, so he calls him the maverick rabbi. Rav Henkin was a maverick. No one stepped on him. No one stepped over him. Even his psakim, if you look into what I refer to as the Adat Yisrael in it, you have no idea how important that volume is. When I was your age, I think it's about 112 pages. I knew those 112 pages by heart. I gave my original copy to one of my sons-in-law, and I was able now to, when I got the new Kolkit Beirav Henkin, so it's right there. But his proposal was simply, you write a get the night of the marriage, Pshutoka Mashmo. How can you write a get? And, he says, all right, you call it, give it a different name, don't frighten them, Ketav Peturin, do it Ketav Meshita. In other words, and the get is given, and it should be Chal before the man dies. It's all worked out halachically, how you would solve all problems. Of course, he makes the comment that his Rebbe, Rav Isa Zalman Meltzer, wrote to him that you may have solved one problem, but you'll create 100 others. And the words of Rav Isa Zalman are to be taken seriously, and I've said this all along, that halachically we can be very innovative. But we have to have responsibility towards Klal Yisrael. And there's always the question of triage in life. It applies in medicine, it applies in... We do not have enough resources to solve all problems. No matter what profession you're in, there's always triage. Even as a rabbi, even as a rebbe, how do you appropriate your time? Who do you meet with? Who do you give more time? Who do you give less time? Is it triage? It's a factor of life. It's a factor in every hospital, a factor for every social worker, a factor for the Knesset today with the budget. And this is a factor in life. And here you can solve a problem. Eino chinami, the woman will have a get. She won't be in a gunna. On the other hand, you'll have a total breakdown of Jewish life. I have to say that I prepared a talk for the West Coast, and one of my two talks there, And I deal with the problems of integration on the American scene, how it has affected the Torah world. And could you just imagine what would be going on in the Torah world today if each person had this get waiting for the woman at the time she wants to activate it, or at the, you know, the Beit Nes, he proposed to you, to Shalim, etc. Could you imagine what would be going on in the Torah world? Shem Yirachem Aleinu. I don't have to go any further. Let's forget about the Pilak Shim. Imagine a Hasidic Rebbe his Gabbai is sitting in jail for having worked over a teenage non-Jewish girl on an airplane. I mean, it defies imagination. I can't even mention it with my mouth. The Rebbe now is indicted. He's going to go up in jail. I mean, we're not talking now YU. We're not talking now Lubavitch. We're talking Williamsburg. You understand? We're talking Williamsburg. So, Shem Yirachem Aleinu. So, we have to have humility. See, Rabbi Rachman, I'll show you something on Tuesday when I earn my salary for the week. It will blow your minds what a Talmud just gave me. And Rabbi Rachman is still suffering from what happened so many years ago. And he has solutions. But you have to look at the total picture. And this is what triage is all about. And I hate to put it that way, but this is a reality in life. And ein hachinami. My heart breaks for a woman who can't get a get. It's a terrible tragedy. On the other hand, with these solutions, Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Yisrael Zalman, you know, when you look at his picture, he was the elder Rosh Yeshiva in the world. Very long, patriarchal beard. Rabbi Yisrael Zalman, concomitantly, was one of the most modern people I ever knew. He had tremendous insight. His wife, you understand, some men in this room can't handle a woman who's brighter than they are. You got to have, understand, you propose, I know setting up fellas over the years, if I mention the girl is too bright, it's not for me, understand. Rabbi Yisrael Zalman's wife, Bella Hinder, who is probably the brightest person alive in the world, she copied over his chidush and prepared them for publication. This is a fact, they have an Ezel, you understand. Bella Hinder Frank, she was a Shein Dover. She was a genius. She was Alam Dunit Mufheket, like Rashi's daughters. So this is Rabbi Yisrael Zalman, this was his wife. But he says, you'll solve one problem, you'll create so many others. However, the problem does not go away. And I now come to one of the most fascinating chapters in American Torah history. The amazing thing is that this chapter, as time marches on, the chapter becomes lost. When I was growing up, everyone spoke about it, yet everyone knew about it. The Sfarim were readily available, and interestingly enough, it's the first time that Brooklyn, Massachusetts goes into the headlines. However, before I can begin, I have to give you a drop of sociological background, which is crucially important. Those of you who have seen the new tradition, how many of you have seen the new tradition, the one in memory of the Rav? Rabbi Lichtenstein, your Rebbe for Gemara, has an article on there on his father-in-law. He has one page out of the whole article which is unbelievable for its insight on a sociological problem. In other words, Rabbaran's article is Rabbaran. But he has one page there where he detours, and it's overwhelming. And for me, it was very important because it was, first of all, it buttressed what I say in my own work on the Rav. And secondly, Rabbaran Kedaka B'Kodesh hits upon exactly certain things I've told the boys over the years, and he puts it into context. And what I want to say is as follows. When we mention the conservative movement today, so there's no question, all of us right away react, conservative movement, reform, conservative, chutz migeder, chutz mitchum, what kind of dialogue can we have with them? What do they know? What do they care? To them, Judaism is eating a kosher at home, treif on the outside, driving to shul on Shabbos, etc., etc., etc. Yeah, this is true. And there's no question that the conservative movement today, I've gone through all the tshuvot, for instance, on women rabbis. I own all the tshuvot. And of course, this Roth, I have a guy named Roth, he's head of the Halachica, the Committee on Jewish Law. And there's no question that their concept of halacha is not traditional, it's not something that we can live with. What you don't realize is that the conservative movement, going back 80, 70, 60 years ago, had many graduates who were basically Orthodox. And you have to understand what happened in America. America begins, JTS is the first Orthodox school for the training of rabbis established in America. It's established in 1887, 1 year after Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. So YU, which claims its roots back to Eitz Chaim, claims it's the oldest Orthodox institution in America. JTS begins as a training school for rabbis. YU began as an elementary yeshiva. 1 year later, they opened up JTS, and it was a reaction. I can't go into great detail now. It was a reaction to the Hebrew Union College. Now, those of you familiar with JTS's charter, the charter is a charter that all of us would sign on 100%. It speaks about Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh and the Mosaic tradition and the oral tradition and loyalty to Jewish law, etc. 100%. Of course, I have to call your attention to the fact that JTS began as a rabbinic seminary. It was not a yeshiva. But the fact that it begins as a rabbinic seminary certainly is not grounds for us to invalidate it. There were many Orthodox rabbinical seminaries. Rabbinical seminaries are a fallout of the modern world, the utilitarian, pragmatic Western society, and I don't have to go any further than the Hildesheim Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin, which to a certain degree was a model for JTS. JTS was modeled somehow on Hildesheim with a little of Breslau in it, but it was meant to be an Orthodox institution. As a matter of fact, among the founders and the first faculty members are strictly Orthodox people, such as Pereira Mendes of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, such as Bernard Drachman of what was then Zichron Achraim. I think today it's called Park Avenue East, if I'm not mistaken, Park East. It was then called Zichron Achraim. And these people were 1,000% strictly Orthodox. Now, JTS develops, and by the turn of the century, it really is not succeeding at all. The reason it's not succeeding is very simple. In order to sell a product, you have to have a product that the people want, the people need. If I come into this room and I want to sell you, for the sake of argument, a pen that writes four different colors, people your age, you know, we're not kids anymore, so you laugh. It's not a product you need. If I can come in with a beautiful sefer, right away everyone will grab it up. What was happening by 1900? JTS is turning out graduates. The graduates have no place in America. Those that are reform want a reform rabbi. By 1900, you have hundreds of thousands of East European Jews who laugh at a JTS graduate. They cook the mind. He can't speak Yiddish anymore. They doesn't know how much Gemara does he learn. You understand? These people that came from Europe, even if they became Mechalalei Shabbos in America. I knew a Jew. I don't know if he's alive. If he's alive, he'd be in his 90s today. I always tell the story. I knew a Jew. The man worked on Shabbos. When he came home, you worked half a day. When I was growing up, you worked 5.5 days. You worked half a day Saturday. So I used to wait. I knew he'd come home at about 1 o'clock. I used to go over. We lived in the same apartment building. I lived in back. He lived in front. I'd run over to his apartment. Mr. Weinstein, can you help me with my Gemara? And what would I find him doing Shabbos afternoon if he got home from work? He was sitting and learning Gemara. This is the way he spent all of Shabbos afternoon, sitting and learning Gemara. So people like this, even if they became Mechalalei Shabbos, they're going to look up to a JTS graduate? So the institution was suffering. The truth is, it would have disappeared. But at that moment, Jacob Schiff got involved. Now, Jacob Schiff himself, again, every theme I'm touching upon is hours of lectures, but I'm doing it very quickly because I want to lead you to Brookline, Massachusetts. Jacob Schiff is one of the most fascinating characters you will ever meet. First of all, the name Jacob Schiff tells you he descends from Gedolei Yisrael. The Maram. These were all his forebears. Number two, he grew up in Frankfurt. He grew up literally on the knee of Rav Shimshon of Fall Hirsch. So this Jacob Schiff comes to America, conquers America, becomes a multi-millionaire before it was fashionable to think in terms of $1 million, if I can put it that way. And in America, when you conquer the world, he becomes not only a member of Temple Emmanuel, he becomes the president of Temple Emmanuel. And the man remained schizophrenic. You probably know in his own house he kept kosher. The guy wouldn't write in Shabbos. When he had yard site for his mother or father, he'd go downtown, daven in the base of Medrash HaGadol one time, and the yard site fell on Shabbos. He stayed in a hotel, and so he could daven in the base of Medrash HaGadol. So they said, "Mr. Schiff, what are you doing here? You're the president of Temple Emmanuel." So he answered, "What, are you crazy? I should keep the yard site for my mother in Temple Emmanuel?" I mean, and this is all documented. You can read Davis's book, The Emergence of Conservative Judaism. But I knew people that knew Mr. Schiff personally. As a matter of fact, my wife's grandmother, who was a bit of a rebel, my wife's grandmother on her father's side, while her husband davened in a shtibble in the Bronx, the mother used to go to the Jacob Schiff Jewish Center because, you know, a shtibble, a woman was behind the 20-foot mechitza, and in the Schiff Jewish Center, I don't know if there was separate seating or mixed seating, but there was no mechitza, and a woman could feel part of the service, etc. So Jacob Schiff says, no, we need an enlightened, the word he used was an enlightened orthodoxy in America. And he puts money into JTS, and he says, we got to get a good faculty, we have to build, and that's how they turned to Solomon Schechter, who, as you all know, was in Cambridge. He had uncovered the Geniza, not discovered the Geniza. The whole history of Torah would have been different in modern times if Yerushalmi wouldn't have been so poor and such batlanim, because Rabaron Wertheimer of Yerushalayim discovered the Geniza, but he was poor, he was a batlan, had to come back to Jerusalem. In the meantime, the word went out, and Solomon Schechter got two widows to underwrite a trip to Egypt. Vayinat slew with Mitzrayim and became world famous for the discovery of Geniza. And they bring Solomon Schechter to America. And by the time he dies in 1915, 1917, there's already a conservative Judaism called conservative in contradistinction to reform, to conserve Judaism. There's no question he was matir certain Isurim, for the sake of argument, mixed pews, part of the davening in English. He develops the whole theory of tradition and change, of historic Judaism, if you evolving Judaism, call it what you wish, a historical school. This was Solomon Schechter. If I could say it very simply, he was orthoprax, but not orthodox. Now, while this is happening, Yeshivas Yisrael Chanan is starting to unfold. But the yeshiva is an east side, second-rate institution. It's viewed as un-American. And the truth of the matter is that many of the students that come over from Europe, come into the yeshiva, spend a few years in the yeshiva, then they Americanize, they go on to medical school, they go on to law school. It's a stepping stone. It gives you a chance to get acquainted with the country. Many fine from people went to JTS. And in their thinking at that time, this was the future. This was America. We can't reproduce Europe exactly the way it was in Europe. We will have to make one or two compromises, but these people were basically committed to Jewish law, understood Jewish law the way we understand it. Solomon Schechter, as a matter of fact, following his death, the second president of JTS is Cyrus Adler. Cyrus Adler basically was a balabas. He wasn't a rabbi. He was a PhD. He was a great Semitic scholar. And he was Shomer Shabbos 100%. He was of German origins. In other words, it was Torim Derech Eretz. Alexander Marx was at JTS. He was the librarian. Who was Alexander Marx? Alexander Marx knew, tell me who he was. That was Reb David Zvi Hoffman's son-in-law. Reb David Zvi Hoffman's son was Alexander Marx, Maxima Golis, the Jewish history book. If you read that book, there's not one word of Apikorsus in there outside of the accepting the Dutro Isaiah theory, which you can quibble with or not quibble whether it is Apikorsus or isn't. But outside of that, there's not one syllable in the book that anyone can quibble with. So you see, there was a certain element at JTS, and it was the dominant element at this time. I can't go into Mordechai Kaplan now. The person who destroys conservative Judaism from our point of view is basically Mordechai Kaplan. And Mordechai Kaplan really had no place in JTS. When you look at his viewpoint, when Mordechai Kaplan leaves the Orthodox fold and develops his theory of Judaism as a civilization, he's basically more reformed than reform. Because he develops a religion that has no God. It's not God-centered. It's people-centered. It's Jew-centered. Man-centered. But he wound up at JTS because he was teaching there. He was the professor. He was the most popular teacher. So when he develops his theories, he develops it at JTS. It's just a strange fact, a funny happening in Jewish history that he was at JTS. He remained there. And then he drives the wedge very wide. And you have, over the years, nothing happens instantaneously. But the 20s into the 30s, you start having that big umbrella opening. But even while that umbrella is opening, there were many rabbis at JTS who basically were Orthodox. They went into synagogues that had mixed pews. This was the American reality. We spoke about it in the Tuesday class. Didn't you fellas ask me about Rabbi Soloveitchik sending rabbis to mixed pews? I said, what do you mean Rabbi Soloveitchik? Why you and Teir of Adas and Chaim Berlin and RJJ? Everyone sent rabbis to mixed pews, whether they did it willingly or not willingly. This was the reality. Rabbis had to earn a living. Doctors need hospitals. You have too many doctors, you have to open up more hospitals. You have to find a way to earn a living. All right? These people, I'm not making any comment. If you know my own life story, how many mixed pews, when I started in the rabbinate, a few conservative rabbis heard me speak. Oh, what they offered me. And I turned it down. They called me a masochist. I remember Rabbi Louis Levitsky called me, may he rest in peace. He was a reconstructionist, drove on Yom Kippur. I mean, it was unbelievable. Conservative offered me a tremendous stella, over 20,000 a year. That was like telling someone today, over 200,000 a year. We're talking 1962 money. It was like today, over 200,000 a year, easily. And I told him, if it doesn't have a mechitza, I can't take it. He looked at me, you're a masochist. I'm not telling you, my own personal life is a different story. But I can understand, rabbis needed shtelas, the Rosh Yeshiva would tell them, go in, see what you can do, a la the Rabbi Steve Riskin story. So these people, and there was a whole school of rabbis like this. I can tell you, for instance, that in the Bronx, when the Concourse, all of you heard of the Grand Concourse. You don't know what the Grand Concourse was. Today you look at the Bronx, it's Vietnam, it's Berlin in 45, of course. That's a different story. Lower Lane, what became of the Bronx. When I was growing up, the Grand Concourse, every woman, every yenta and every male yenta, what, you live on the Grand Concourse? It was like the height of achievement. And there was this major shul, Concourse Center of Israel, where I taught and ran the youth service. When did I reach there? 60, 61, the year I got smicha. And that Grand Concourse and that shul, the rabbi was Rabbi Max Strohop. He was a seminary graduate out of the 1910s, distinguished, fine Yirei Shemayim, dignified, polished. All right, the shul had no machitza. That was America. At the seminary turned out people, Herbert S. Goldstein. You understand, Herbert S. Goldstein's a seminary product. Herbert S. Goldstein never even identified with Mizrahi. He used to be on a good day. He was a member of Agudat Yisrael. We're talking about West Side Institutional Synagogue. You don't know how powerful that synagogue was. You know today on the West Side, there's Riskin's old shul, where Rabbi Adam Mintz is today. There's my student, Rabbi Schwartz, Alan Schwartz, who resuscitated Ohep Tzedek, OZ. There's Rabbi J.J. Schachter, the Jewish Center that never lost it. So West Side Institutional is the least of the synagogues. It's Rabbi Mordechavich never really caught on like the other rabbanim. So it's a played out area today. But at one time, what the West Side Institutional was, Herbert S. Goldstein was a seminary graduate. Now, I can go on and on and give more names. It's not necessary. And they really believed. In other words, in their minds, they really believed, look, this is America. You have to make certain compromises. Just like YU, if you want an analogy, it's very simple. Lakewood, a nice Lakewood boy who's honest, would say, all right, Rabbi Rebbe was a good man, he meant well, but he thought he had to make compromises going to college. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a good man, he meant well, but he had to make compromises going to college. They thought that in America, you have to go to college. We in Lakewood have shown the world that the Torah has not changed. We don't go to college. We don't waste time in secular studies. The Talmud Torah connected Kulam. America is no different than Voloshin. Rabbi Soloveitchik's forebears shut down the Voloshin yeshiva rather than introduce 2 hours a day secular studies. We proved it can be done in America. And now all of these concepts of YU are fossils. dinosaurs, we want no part of it. And if you still advocate the concept of Toru Mata, you're an Epicurus. It may be it was all right in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, but Chas v'Chalila in the 90s, into the year, into the 21st century, you don't have to make these compromises. Mashallah Mahadavid Doma, this is exactly, these conservative rabbis were basically the whole school. They were orthodox, they were polished, they had dignity, they cared, they were concerned, they were not matiri surim. They had mixeding, they had a little bit of the davening in English. All right, mixeding, what can you do? It's America. Virginia Slims is smoking a cigarette. This is the price we have to pay for being in America. Virginia Slims is wearing slacks. This is the price we have to pay for being in America. Now, there's another factor too that's very interesting. A lot of these rabbis, as a matter of fact, the overwhelming majority were not even American born. You have to understand that the concept of someone being American born and going to a yeshiva is a concept that doesn't become, I would say, plausible until the 1930s. It doesn't become popular until the 1950s. When I went to yeshiva, even in my time, I was in the minority. Most of the kids were European children, were born in Europe. People looked at me, what, your father played baseball with Hank Greenberg like I was a hero, you understand? My father and Hank Greenberg grew up a few blocks from us in the Bronx. What's the big deal? He came from a Jewish house and he played sandlot ball. All the Jewish kids all played baseball. It's no big deal. But it was unheard of. These are kids, their homes, their fathers didn't know what baseball was, you understand? They're Europeish people. So now, it's interesting too, and why you in my time, when you had the oral exams, I'll tell you an unbelievable story. You had the oral exams. So, you had to go in on 100 daf gemara, plus your a day. I don't know what else, you'd have to ask one of the old times, because it's before my time. Thank God it's before my time. Because these oral exams were murder, you understand, the Rav was sitting there, depending on his mood, he could eat you up alive. You understand? Dr. Belkin used to sit there to calm the student down. Now, Rav Moshe Shatsky has lended his presence, but the Rav, of course, was the dominant figure. So you went on 100 blat gemara. So I remember a guy, he died already, Rabbi Kaisman, rest in peace. He went in, and the Rav got hysterical at him. Why? Because he chose 100 daf gemara. He went in on Megillah and Tainit and Chveis. And the Rav got a start. He goes, what are you, an American born? He says, you're a Payusha. He was a European guy. He first arrived in America after World War II. He understand the Rav from a guy like that? You learned already in Europe, in Cheder. You come in on Isi Mesechta, the Rav went crazy. A guy like you has to come in on Baba Batra, on Yevamot, you understand, on Eruvin. I don't know if anyone ever did on these Mesechta, but, you know, there was a dual standard. An American kid, you expected, all right, he's an American kid. Baruch Hashem, he knows how to learn the Daf Gemara. A Yerupeish, like Rav Meir Simcha Feldblum. Rav Meir Simcha already arrived in the yeshiva. He was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. He already had learned in Tells in Europe before the Holocaust. He was an Ilui. I think he got into Tells at the age of 12. I mean, it's. You understand? Many of these rabbis that went to the seminary already came to America steeped in Torah. Now we come to Louis Epstein. Louis Epstein, or Yehuda Lev Epstein, I'll give you his years, 1887, 1949. He was born in Lithuania. He emigrated to America in 1904. So do the cheshbon. He came to America at the age of 17. You know what that means? It's not 17 of today. Today you take the average high school graduate who spent already 12 years in yeshiva, he knows next to nothing. And there are reasons why the yeshiva today are fighting a tremendous battle just to keep the kids from. I mean, you understand the kid today is going to yeshiva high school. Number one, it's a miracle if the kid didn't experiment with drugs. Number two, it's a miracle if the kid doesn't have a big supply of liquor. Number three, it's a miracle if the kid is not an expert on sexual activity. And you understand, today with kids, this is the reality of the world. And so it's a frightening thing. If you know it's going to be on the TV tonight, the Israeli TV, it's mind-boggling. Prime time, government time, channel, the prime channel. They gave a preview already early today, the Kamari 5, whatever they call it. I don't want to mention this. Idiots. You understand? And these kids are going to be exposed. 12-year-old girls, I heard the preview tonight, told my wife when she came home from her father, we were shaking. We were shaking what kids at 9 o'clock tonight or 10 o'clock tonight, what they're going to be exposed to on TV. Is there any reason why a kid at the age of 16, 17 isn't a sexual pervert? It's a miracle if he's not. So the yeshiva can't teach today. You have to educate, pray, drill, hashkafa, cajole, bring down Harsinai that the kid should remain chach from, in our circles at least. A kid comes out of Europe in the early 1900s, 17 years of age. At that age, he could already have smicha. Dr. Belkin had smicha at the age of 17. You started learning, reread my book, read the way the Rav describes how he started learning. He used to come home at night from cheder with a lantern. That's how dark it was. You started 8 o'clock in the morning, and you came home 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, and then he first started learning with his father. You understand? Those days, we punish them, and the kid, you knew, it was like the children of Israel, Kanain Hara, I see my grandchildren, the master of the language, of the mission, of the Gemara, too good, because there's a tremendous problem. Like my grandchildren can read a Gemara, you so beautifully, you think they understand every word. Anechtekatag, don't understand one word, but they read it so beautifully, there's such mastery of the language already, that with such a sing-song, they rattle it off. You understand? It's taka wonderful. On the other hand, you got to be careful. Don't fall for the niggin. They got to see if they know. So this Epstein comes to America and he goes to the seminary. He graduates JTS in 1913. What's the choice then? There's no YU. It's not like today. You have to put yourself in the mindset of the 1910s, the 1900s. He goes to the seminary. This is where it's at. This is Orthodoxy in America. This is the level. And you got to look at it. Look, the way they davened in Satma, the way they davened in Mumkach, was different than the way they davened in Lithuania. And the way they davened in Lithuania is always different than the way they davened in America. Each country has its own. How do we say it in Halacha? The rivers, each river flows its own way. This is America. This is JTS. Now, he becomes the rabbi of Kehilat Yisrael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Now that already tells you something interesting. I just call your attention to this from a sociological point of view. Again, every topic I could give you so many sources, but it's, you understand, conservative Judaism by the 1920s is conquering America. The German Jew came to America already reformed. Reform Judaism is German Judaism. It began in Germany. There was the tremendous German Bavaria emigration to America before the Civil War. After the Civil War, that's reform. Then the East Europeans come in the 1870s, 1890s, 1900s. It reaches a crescendo, World War One. It ends, but over onto 2 million East Europeans have arrived in America. Their Jewry is Torah, Orthodoxy. The second generation becomes conservative. Reform is too far gone for them. It's too guyish, too Gentile. But they're conservative. And wherever you find the large conservative temples, those are the beautiful areas. Because those are the areas of the second generation Jews who made it in America, who have affluence, have wealth. And this already tells you, when you speak of a prominent conservative temple in Brookline as early as the 1920s, it tells you right away that in Brookline, Massachusetts, it was a nice community. This is a suburb. This is where the wealthy Jews live. And inevitably, the wealthy Jews are Reform or conservative. You don't find an Orthodox synagogue in suburbia till the 1950s. And this repeats itself all over. This is why I always tell you the story of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, when he came to America and he tells his few Hasidim in America, find me the fanciest place in New York. That's why I want to open up my shtibbel. And they found Eastern Parkway. How did you know Eastern Parkway was the fanciest place in New York? Because the largest conservative temple in greater New York was right there. Brooklyn Jewish Center. You understand? Rabbi Leventhal. The son of the Leventhal of Philadelphia, Rabbi Leventhal, is in Brooklyn Jewish Center. this is the fanciest Rabbi Israel Leventhal, this is the fanciest. And then Rabbi Israel Leventhal is himself an example. Here's a man who went to JTS, was Orthodox in his own practice. He took one of the biggest shtelas in the world at that time. All right, there was mixed seating. Outside of mixed seating, a little English in the davening, there was no other deviation. So he was a Talmud Chacham, this Louis Epstein. He becomes president of the rabbinical assembly. He becomes the chairman of the committee on Jewish law. And Louis Epstein is a class act. You see from his writings, the man was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. Now, what did he do? What did he do? Number one, he republished Rav Alkalai's proposal. All of you have to understand that Rav Alkalai's proposal was basically never published. It was in Algeria. It was written in manuscript. It might have been circulated in a primitive form, mimeographed form, or whatever they had at that time. I believe it was mimeographing. I saw the original at the Hebrew University. I have a Xerox copy here. Literally, it's in handwriting. It's in a very primitive form. He republished Rav Alkalai's tshuva. Now, what was the tremendous problem of Rav Alkalai's tshuva? He gave authorization to write a get. Fine. But who says the Sefer and the Edim are going to be alive at the time that the woman needs the get? So you come up with, Rav Alkalai came up with the idea that he gives an authorization, whoever will see his handwriting, his ketav yad, and this gets involved in the whole problem of milei. In other words, there's nothing concrete here. 30, 40, 50 years later, a sefer is going to look at a handwriting. How can that empower him to write a get? Lishma, lishma, l'shem geirushim. And that was the tremendous problem with Rav Alkalai's proposal. He makes mention in his writings of Rav Henkin's proposal, the Ketav Meshita, the Sefer Patur, or Sefer Paturin, or Yigeret Paturin, whatever you want to call it. And he comes up with his own proposal. He publishes two volumes. The first volume, 1930, Hatza'ah Leman Takanat Agunat. It's a proposal. It's a slim volume. If I recall correctly, it was soft-covered. It's 10 years later that he proposes, that he publishes a hard-covered volume. What's interesting about the proposal in 1930 is that it was published in Newark. And that also tells us something. Newark probably was the most religious city in the United States. It's very fascinating. Percentage-wise, the Shmuel Shabbat in Newark was greater than in New York City proper. Newark had some of the greatest Rabbanim, Rav Kanvich, Rav Mendelssohn, Hasidic Rebbeim. It was an amazing thing what Newark had. Newark, you know, was, first of all, it's a seaport. People came in there, settled there. There's a lot of industry nearby. It's not far from New York City, and yet it's not caught up in New York City. It's New Jersey. Newark developed, you have no idea what a heart, a bastion of Judaism Newark was. It's hard to conceive of it, because ultimately, by the 1950s, all their children and grandchildren moved to the suburbs, and the biggest reform and the biggest conservative temples, the president of the reform rabbis, the president of the conservative rabbinate, everyone came from Essex County. But Newark originally was mamish, a hotbed of Yiddishkeit. And you can imagine that, printing plants there, and then you had to set type. Wherever you set type, you had to set type each letter. It's not like today, computerization. The letters had to be set. You remember with the heat, with the printing. You had to have Talmidei Chachamim and proofreaders. So you can imagine what Newark had that they could publish Svarim. And in his Sefer Hatzalah Man Agunat, he comes up with his own proposal. He gives an entire introduction. And in his introduction, it's like a rerun of this class. The man was a fine Talmud Chacham. And he speaks about, even remember the sefer I quoted to you in America, the Turei Zahav from Rav Adamson, where Rav Adamson proposes Kedushin Al Tanai, and he, in the introduction to his proposal, he says, yes, this may be a sound proposal, but Rav Kook was opposed. And he quotes Rav Kook's letter that Rav Kook is opposed, and he says, Ani la nivetati, he says, I humbly agree with Rav Kook that this Kedushin Al Tanai cannot be a good proposal. And he says, first of all, Rav Kook is right that the rabbis that are Masonic Kedushin, generally speaking, will never be able to do a proper Kedushin Al Tanai. It's beyond their comprehension. You have to know, Talmud Chacham, Haim Kodim Lalav. You have to know how to make a Tanai. And the average person doesn't understand what you're talking about. And he says, no, Kedushin Al Tanai. And not only that, he brings the whole problem, which is an ethical problem, of the children. What happens in Kedushin Al Tanai, you retroactively abolish the marriage. Well, when you retroactively abolish the marriage, it means the children are born out of wedlock. And even though the children are not mamzerim, but he says that there's a, let me quote his words, yulei pegumim b'muvan hanimusi. In other words, see, there's a very delicate question here. Are we allowed to allow a secular concept of ethics affect our halachic thinking? We live in the Western world. When I was growing up, a child born out of wedlock was a badge of shame. You understand? Now, that's a Gentile way of thinking. A child born out of wedlock is not a mamzer, he's just a child born out of wedlock. I mean, today we're living in a different world. I'm not today's world. I have to tell you one thing about the president. He wasn't my student, but I can't believe how he quoted me. You heard, Jack, you heard what he said. Remember the analogy I made? Speaking to the high school kids on Friday, he made the analogy, tell me, do you believe in Mishkavei Behema? He said, it's the same thing. You know, the Torah speaks about both of them. And I went, but who would ever dream we'd live in a world where the president of the state of Israel would come out against homosexuality and two blocks from my house, the homosexuals and lesbians were demonstrating last night. You understand? Two blocks from my house. I was busy on the book, otherwise I would have walked out to see the site. But this way I just treated myself to 4 minutes on the television. But you know, we live in a crazy world today. But forget about the world in which I live, which we live. When I was growing up, a child born out of wedlock was considered a badge of shame. So he says here, not only do we have the problem that the rabbis don't know what to do, but he says ethically, morally, it means that that we Jews living in the Western world are living in a situation where all our children can be what the Gentile world calls bastards. Alright? I don't know, it's an interesting question. It just so happens that Danny Mann asked me a question earlier dealing with a similar problem. I gave him some sources. It's an interesting question. Do we have a right to allow Western morals to enter the halachic scheme? It's an interesting question. Are we troubled? The child born out of wedlock? All right, it's not nice, but he's not a mamzer. But on the other hand, if we have all our children born out of wedlock, everyone's retroactively annulling their marriages, it's certainly not nice. I can understand what he's saying. It's not nice. What do you want to comment? So you're saying that maybe that Metziah, that could be. He doesn't discuss it here. He just makes this point. You're right. You're saying that the fact is that they'll need a secular divorce. Who knows? Maybe he won't give her. I'd say that shows that at least is good. Fine, I'll agree. But he's saying that it's not nice. Yes, what do you want to say, Alicia? So you say practically because a child born out of wedlock, it's a pagum, it's not a nice thing. Even forget about Western values. That even though it's not a mamza, But practically and from our point, say that you may be right. I don't know. I'm thinking aloud. I don't know. See, my mind is so used to thinking in halachic terms. The child is not a mamzer. So all right, the child is not a mamzer. He's a perfectly good, normal Jewish child. But he says it's a moral problem that all these children technically can become bastards, even though they're not mamzerim. Okay, but anyway, he brings up the whole question that what you say too. The word sneer is thrown in here too, so that would sort of buttress what you're trying to say. Okay, well, he shows that Kedushin al Tanai is not going to work, and he says, but there were tremendous proposals made, and he quotes the Algerian proposal. And then everything is in shorthand, but everything is absolutely accurate. Now, before he can go into what he wants to propose, and he says it's true, there were problems with these proposals. Before he can go into what he wants to propose, he says, in simple language, who am I? Modesty. Notice he's totally within the world of Torah. Then he tells a very interesting story. Now this little story becomes a great source of controversy. And he says, when I visited Eretz Yisrael the past summer, I spoke with the Rav HaRashi and some of the other great Rabbanim in Yerushalayim about the idea. And they were not askance to it. They listened carefully. As a matter of fact, it was only in Eretz Yisrael that I found out about Rav Alkalai's proposal. And then he quotes in great detail Rav Alkalai's proposal, and finally he says, I now want to make my proposal, and he makes the point that my proposal is better than Rav Henkin, better than Rav Alkalai. And while they were the first ones to think of the concept of arranging for divorce the night of the marriage, my proposal does not have the halachic problems they have. Now, before I go one step further, I just want to make another sociological comment. What does it tell you, the fact that he visited Eretz Yisrael in 1929 and 1930? See, again, it holds true to form. He's rabbi of an affluent, conservative congregation. He's in the suburbs. You have any idea what it costs to visit Israel? Think for a minute. You had to go by boat. The trip, the expense. Very few did it. Visiting in Israel was a sign of affluence. Very interesting. Also notice that he walks freely among the greatest Rabbanim in Yerushalayim. And you'll see later he claims they accepted him, spoke with him, said nice things about him. He quotes Balabatim afterwards, who visited and spoke with Rav Kook. So you see, it was a different world then. I can't conceive of conservative rabbis coming today and moving among the great Rabbanim of Yerushalayim as easily as Rabbi Epstein did. But it was a different era. He was a different type of person. It's a different type of conservative rabbi. And this is a different type of sefer. This is a sefer totally within the halacha. Now, what is his chiddush? And this is just amazing how late Beit Medrash believed chiddush. I mean, after all, Rav Alkalai made the proposal leaving a Ktav HaShah. Rav Henkin made the proposal actually leaving a get should be chal right after the last time the couple had relations, and a ketav mishiter and a ketav peturin, whatever you want to call it. Okay. He comes along and he makes the proposal that the night of the wedding, the husband empowers his wife to write a get for herself. She should have the power. And you see, there's sources. It's not, he's not coming totally out of left field. Can a woman write a get? Absolutely. In order to write a get, what do you have to be? Can a Gentile write a get? Absolutely not. Can a woman write a get? Of course. She's a Bakritut. She's involved. She's a Bakadushin. She's involved with marriage. If she's involved with marriage, then she's involved with divorce. She can cut off. She goes into marriage. She's one half the story. You need her acquiescence. She has to be willing to accept. The same thing with the get. Well, if she is involved, then she can write a get. And this way, if you appoint a woman to write a get, then she could learn, or she can empower someone else. Let's say she never learns how to write her own get. She never becomes a soferet. Today we have women who are sofrat, who can write the ketav of a sefer. I have one daughter who writes, could write a Megillah, let's say. It's a machlokes rishonim if a man could use the Megillah, but certainly women could use the Megillah that my daughter could write. So it's a different world today, a different world. But at that time, alright, the woman could learn, and even if she does, she can tell someone else. Now what's the tremendous gain by empowering your wife to write her get? What have you solved? You have solved the problem of authorization. Because the wife heard the authorization from the husband. She heard it with her own 2 years, ears. Of course, she heard it 10, 20, 30 years earlier, but she heard it. If she's not alive, she doesn't need a get. I mean, it's a tremendous chap here. It's unbelievable how insightful this guy was. If she's not alive, you know, if you come with Rav Akilai's proposal and the cipher is dead and the Eidim are dead and Echveis the Beitin is dead, so Ribbono Shel Olam, they're all dead, they're all gone. But here you have a tremendous advantage. The one person that needs the get, by definition, she's only going to need a get if she's alive. Dead people do not a get need. They're not involved, not with get, not with chalitza, not with zika, not with jibum. You understand? It's tremendous. The guy, it's unbelievable. Now, what is the big problem with Rav Henkin? With Rav Henkin's proposal, it's a terrible problem. A woman has a get lying around. A woman has a get in her safe. A woman can activate the get, go to the beitin. All of marriage becomes brought down. It's brought down a notch. It's all of marriage stands the risk of being denigrated. Here it's not a get. It's an authorization to write a get. So it's a little less of a denigration. And here's the proposal. Hatzah Shali, that the Rav of the Masada Kedushin has to make the following minui shlichut. Bafanei deinim, that the Edim have to sign that the Chatan who got married to this woman on this and this day and this place, and immediately after the Kedushin, before he took it to Chuppah, said to her, "Bezeh halashen, hare yani ploni ben ploni memane otach et ishti plonit bat ploni lichtov get latzmeich bifnei beitin ploni vafilu ad meya gittin." This is the form of hashah. I taught you. You know what is that? Ad meya gittin doesn't only mean 100; it can mean 10 times. It means until you get one get that is kosher. Ad meya gittin l'shmiu l'shmeichu l'shem geirushin shetit garesh bo bimeni kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. Vanima manen, you spell out the names at Ploni ben Ploni, Ploni ben Ploni. Oh, kol shneim b'Yisrael. Hamakirin k'tav yodiyu, k'tav yodei eidim, shem yitzu beitin, yiyah kol chad min hon eid lachtom haleget, she tichtavi, vafiluad mea gitten. And again, you mamana to eidim, to be the eidei chatima, the eidei netina, the Eidei Mesira, the Eidei Chatima, be the Eidei won't be alive. So here, of course, you have the Hashar of anyone that will know my handwriting, or anyone that will see the Shtah, which of course will be the Shtah, that the Beitin will be Mekayim, what's the word we would use? A notary public. Understand? That's what Kiyum Shtarit means, essentially, is what we have in modern law as the concept of a notary public. And he says to her, Umi, that you will be the shliach of holacha until the Beitin will appoint the shliach to receive it from you, And then that shlich will give you the get, because shlich to bring it. But vakabli et gitech mimeni uteche yadoki yadiyu pivke pive diburo ke diburi vasiyatoka siyato kasiyati veninatinatoka netinati. It's exactly the lashon of me being mamana shlich, and he's the shlich lahalacha, and you be makabalet ukeshe tagia haygetzel yadech teimugureshik mimeni umuteret lachol adam ulezech. And here, of course, when he has to protect himself, when does he power to the shlich lo lacha to give it to his wife? In other words, 3 years. Now, I have to tell you something. What does this concept mean of 3 years? In other words, if I leave her, or if I don't support her for 3 years, she has the right to go to Beitin and activate the get. I would say nowadays, if this proposal were being made in the year 1997, I would say we would say 1 year. And I'll tell you why. And it's not that's because the world today is much smaller. It's like the whole problem of Aguna. The whole concept of Avad Zichro, if you're familiar with the literature, Rabbi Elazar Meir Vodun, one of the Rishonim, so it was a 7-year concept. Today in the halachic literature, Avad Zichro is a 1-year concept. And I would say it's obvious why 1 year. Because it's a smaller world. If the man disappeared, you can locate him, you can find him within a year. I mean, the international communications today, I don't have to tell you what a world in which we live. Forget about the email and all that other. Just the phone. Sometimes I get phone calls, and I say to the person, where are you speaking to me from? He says, oh, I'm Teaneck, New Jersey. It sounds like you're next door. It's an amazing world today. So I would say today, but he has 3 years. Also, I think there are other factors at work, too, that people then could get lost more readily. The whole world today is, not only that the world is smaller and international communication, I hope I'm not wrong, we're more attuned to these problems. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, people are more sensitive. Husbands who desert wives, agunat, there's been so much commotion and so much talk and so much speech that, you know, people want to help. I don't think a man could get away as easily as what he could get away with decades ago. I may be wrong. I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud. I know my daughter just told me about a case that she just handled because she gave me some checks to deposit for her today. So I noticed them. I said, what, you represented that woman again? She said, yeah, it's a whole story of information. I can't go into detail, but a very fascinating story of Balei Tshuva, and she's a convert, and this guy, I met him at the Kotel. I mean, to look at him, he looks like the head of, like the way you would want the head of the way you would want the Rebbe saying the Shir now to look. Black clothes, a beard, payas. So it turned out he sued now for custody of the children after the divorce. And my daughter brought into court, he molested his daughters. He's sick. And she told me that the Av Beit Din, who you met at the Brit, the Av Beit Din immediately ruled in favor of the wife, not the husband. And there was another dayan there, a Svadi dayan, who was one of the three dayanim. He was going crazy. He didn't know the case. He didn't know the whole story. But what? You know, in a minute, you rule in favor of the woman, not in favor of the man. And thank God, the Av Beit Din, and he couldn't even talk Yiddish to him, because sometimes my daughter tells me that dayanim redden sich Yiddish, ain't him at the under, they straighten each other out in Yiddish. This guy is like talking Yiddish to Rav Avadji Yosef. This is why Shas exists. If the Moetzet Gedeli HaTeda would have had a little seichel and spoken Hebrew, Rav Avadji today would be in Agudat Yisrael. Agudat Yisrael today would have 20 seats in the Knesset. But the Moetzet Gedeli HaTorim, Giret no Yiddish, the Rav Avadji said, take your Yiddish, go fly a kite, and he today owns the world. There's no one that owns the world like Rav Avadji Yosef. He is the king of the world. The fact that his prime minister is going to be in jail shortly is going to create a lot of heartache for him. I feel sorry for Rav Avadja, because it's a terrible thing when your son/student is going to wind up in jail. But you don't have to worry, they'll form a national unity government, and the deal will be that the president has to give him a pardon. And you write down that Aaron Reichheff had said it on this date, and we'll see over the next few years what's going to be. But anyway, Etnishke kennt red in Yiddish, so my daughter said he used the cold word, Atak Volk Haram, you know, he referred to each other, said Labriya, the third person. You don't know the details of the case. But my daughter told me it was the first time she ever saw that the Av Beitin, without any dispute, didn't want to hear, knew the case, saw the pictures, saw the report of the social worker, gave the woman full custody, threw the man out in his head, with his beard, with his players, with his bekisha, and with his strimel, and with his gartel. And you understand, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I believe that today, the Rabbanim are much more sensitive. I can tell you, when I was a young rabbi, I didn't know anything about wife abuse and beating women. It didn't exist. It wasn't in our vocabulary. Maybe it happened. We didn't know about it. We were ashamed to talk about it. Today, I am so sensitized because I see what goes on. The OU has to hold the convention of mikveh ladies and teach mikveh ladies to look at a woman when you have to look at her before she goes to mikveh to check that there's no chatzitza. You have to check that there are no belt marks on her body. You understand? I can puke telling you this, but this is what happened. This is what happened. This has happened this year. It's not ancient history. So today I would say 1 year, not 3 years. But, and he says, or, if she has a secular divorce and he refused to give a get, then you don't have to wait 3 years. The minute there's a secular divorce, you don't want to give a get, we activate this get. Now, the whole problem is, what about the betel? Ingenious. And he says, "V'hinani makabel alai b'shvuat haTorah, shelo levatel lo asegat, v'lo atashluchim, v'lo atashlichet, v'lo atashahanal, u'mavatel anochi." And it's just amazing. He covers everything. First of all, I take an oath on the Torah that I'm never going to abrogate or nullify the shlichut to you and the get and the ketav hoshar. And if I should ever in a moment of anger say, damn it, you know the way people speak in a moment of anger, that get I gave you is worthless. My words have no effect. It's like a Torah Nedarim, right? We Jews, we're Mataneda, and right after you finish Mataneda, you say, V'hini Moseh Modar, right or wrong, any nether I'm going to make the years worthless. So I have to be Mataneda a year later? Can anyone answer that question for me? Think about it. Here you are, Mataneda. Right, you with me or not? Then we said, "Kol mutar, like a kol mutar, like when Shmuel, like when Shmuel, like when Yankin, like when Yankin, like when Yankin, like when Yankin, like when Yankin." Beautiful. Then he says, "Hareini Moseh Modah lifnei Habeitin, etc." And in that Modah, he says, "Any nether I'm going to make is knocked out." That's what you. And yet, a year later, we start off as if we never said Hareini Moseh Modah. It's an interesting question. But what's important here is that the man says, and if anyone should testify that in a moment of anger, I cursed at my wife, and I said, "The hell with you, and the get is nullified, and you should rat, and you should..." If you know Jewish curse words, the Jewish language, the cursing was unbelievable. "You should live to take your daughter to chuppah and have an epileptic attack under the chuppah and drop dead of heart arrest while everyone is watching." You understand what he says? No. If anyone will come and testify, I passel him that he cannot testify. I don't believe him. He's not telling the truth. I didn't mean it. And he says, there's nothing. And also, I swear that my wife can be believed, because look what can happen. The woman is the woman is hard pressed. She needs money from the man. Those days, okay? And the guy, all right, he says, "Honey, I'm going to buy you a new refrigerator, chveis. I'm going to buy you a new car. I'm going to buy you a new, whatever it was today, chveis, a new video, a new this and that. But you got to give up that get you have in your safe." And the woman says, well, she wants the money, she gives it up, because who knows, he's a nice man now, he's giving her the car, giving her the video, giving her whatever she wants, the frost refrigerator, etc. So he says, even that, he says, my wife is to be totally believed, and if she says that I never forgave, that I never did something to make her nullify what I'm doing, she is to be believed, not me. Adam sign, the Rav who's Masadarit signs, and he writes, he says, it's not that that the Rav has to sign, he says. But he says, for good bookkeeping, I think that's the expression lawyers use, Laman HaSeda HaTov. How do you say, anyone here a lawyer? What's the English word for that? In Hebrew they write, Laman HaSeda HaTov. I've seen legal documents. I don't know how to translate it. For good bookkeeping, for good order, so the Rav should sign. He says, now, many times you don't have, it's just amazing the way the man writes. Every word is Alpi Din Torah. There's not one thing in his writings that you can say. It's not like the conservative, when they with ordaining the conservative women, you understand, it's a terrible problem. The problem is not ordaining a woman. You can give a woman a smicha a million times over. We know women got smicha. There were women who were sheikhtot, right or wrong. You fellas learn shchita. There were women had kabbalah and shchita, particularly offered, particularly chickens. We have documents already from Italy where women had kabbalah. Excuse me. Say there, documents from Italy where women had Kabbalah on smicha and offer. We punish loyalim. What's going on here? Smicha, shmicha. What does smicha mean? All it means is you passed a few exams. The problem is a different problem altogether. That the rabbinic acts, the rabbinic functions, such as eidot, a woman cannot be. This is eidot the lekiyim dava. It's with bira dava mela. Any bet in the world it can accept women. Even the eidah haredit women testify. That's a different story. But that's Bira Dava. Kiyam Dava, a woman cannot be. And what about Geirut? What about to be on a Beit Din of Geirut? A woman, this is the problem. So when you read the Tshuva today, when they finally amate women rabbis, you can plot because they think the halacha would say, well, this is a minority opinion, this and that. It's no halacha. And even worse, when they were matir, woman chazoniyot, remember that's much worse than woman rabbi. So let's say a woman said, look, I'm only a rabbi, I'm going to preach sermons, I'm going to make pastoral visits, but any function of conversion, of marriage, divorce, I will send to an Orthodox rabbi to do. And by the way, you should know that there were many conservative rabbis, the overwhelming majority in the 30s, 40s, anything like conversion or get, always went to the Agudat HaRabbanim. They always sent it on to the Agudat HaRabbanim rabbis. So the woman will say, fine, so that kind of rabbi, what can you object? You can say maybe it's not sanu. A woman should speak in front of a social speak at the kiddush Shabbos morning. The chveis, the women will sit in front of the shul. You can come out. It's crazy, but in Rabbi Lukstein's congregation, they have a female minion once a month. They just had an ufrif there. So I read in Jewish Week how the father of the bride sat behind. They had a mechitza for men who attended the woman's congregation to see the woman called up to the Torah. All right, believe me, my heart is not happy with it. But you can say, okay, but the evidence halachically justifiable. Women chazaniyot? How could a woman be a chazanit? She's not mechuyevet, but davanka she motziat sipur. What's going on here? So you should see the tshuva that, and this wrath comes out of a woman's makabelet on herself. She has to daven three times a day, put on tefillin every day, and then she makabelet, she becomes chayevet, then she takes it on, she could be. This is halachic garbage, not halachic thinking. But this Louis Epstein, he thinks halachically. And he even deals with the problem of Adam Ksherim, which again, you fellas can't understand. What a haunting problem this was in America. I told you more than once, when I was Masada Kedushin, I always took a Talmud to marry. I used to tell the people, you have to give my student $5. It was a lot of money in those days, because I don't know whether I'll have two Sabbath observing witnesses, so I'll be one and my student will be the other one. So he says, you know, the Ravka de Milta, it looks better, you should have two Adam and the rabbi. But if you can't have two kosher Adam, so the rabbi becomes one of the Adam, and he has to get someone else that should be the other aid. Now, he's very sensitive here. Then he goes on and he says, how should you do this? He says, look, you can't do this publicly. To do this publicly at a wedding, you understand, it's a terrible thing. It's a funeral at a wedding. Well, if you know, we don't, if there's a funeral wedding, you have the wedding goes one way, the funeral goes another way. You can't do them together. It's just, you know, there's a limit to the emotions we can mix in life. It's understandable. So he says, The rabbi has to meet with them privately. And he has an interesting, and I have one question here which he doesn't explain. And he says, privately, he has to marry the woman before the public ceremony. Why does he have to marry the woman? Because without Kedushin, again, it's not Shayach. Understand, I'm going to walk around Chveis, and I see a nice girl in Midrashet Moriah, and I say, I'm going to give you a get. What do I have to do with that girl? I'm not married to her. What does she need a get from me? Now, even though it's your girlfriend and your sweetheart and you're engaged to her, but she's not married to you yet. So you're going to give her a get? What get? When get? How get? So he says, he has to, and you know what my problem is? My problem is very simple. What happens afterwards? You get married in public. When do they make the brachat? Mimonavshach. If you make the brachat in private, so what do you need the whole public ceremony for? And if you don't make the brachat in private, how can you make the brachat under the chuppah if you already gave the kedushin? I don't know. He doesn't discuss it. That question. What do you want to say? Are you have a solution?
Yeah, I mean, if you just do kedushin, not necessarily, you still could give a
get. Yeah, no. I'm saying he marries her privately, but birchat kedushin I'm talking about, not the sheva brachat. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. The sheva brachas, I understand. But he seems to imply that you do it. Let me share. So first of all, you have kedushin. You have to have kedushin, so she should be an eshetish. Once she's an eshetish, you can divorce her. So he says, first you give the kedushin. Then you read this whole Shtam, I hope, proposal. You read it in Hebrew, and I don't understand Hebrew, obviously. You're dealing American 1930s. You read it in English. He evidently prepared an English version. Now, by the way, all the Rabbanim have English versions. When everything we're talking about in Eshetish, I saw Rav Melech Shechta give a get. He has a whole English version he used to read from. A whole English, I don't know if he ever published it. I told you, a book came out, didn't I tell the class? Maskeret Pinchas, I think it's called. Pinny Box, Zeichet Tzadok, you know, Rabbi Riskin's Undoing. You know what I'm talking about? I mentioned it. I mean, Rabbi Riskin's Undoing. He had Rabbi Benjamin Back, the Zecher Tzadik Levracha of Baltimore. Rabbi Back was a Talmud of the Rav in the Kollel in Boston, 39-40. He was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. He had a son. I believe the son was an Israel graduate. He was not a YU boy. That son was the principal of Riskin's High School. He was the greatest machanech you can imagine. Students flocked around him. I told you, he had a heart attack on Purim, dancing with his students. I can tell you, people who were dancing with him at that time, no one came out of it normal. That's all I can tell you. Each one. There's a guy here, Mordechai Gafni, who's conquering Jerusalem today. If anyone can tell me that Gafni is normal, I'll buy him an ice cream soda. Belineta. You can't get ice cream soda. I'll buy you a pizza. Wherever you want. Pizza Hut, Shmitza Hut. Wherever you tell me, you got a pizza. The Rebbe pays for it. If you can tell me that guy. But he was holding hands, understand, in the circle around Bach. So he died. And that was Riskin. Riskin then went under. His whole American operation, one by one, like falling dominoes. Because you won't believe this. Why you was frightened stiff of Riskin. You can't believe it today. Riskin was going out of high school, and he's going to have a smicha program. He had a Beit Medrash, and before you know it, he'll have a college, and he had a program for women, and he had this and that. Why he was frightened. I mean, get sitted. You can't understand that today. And when Bach died, one by one, Riskin comes in Aliyah. Here he's built the whole world. Here I think it's different because there are a lot of good people available. Israel attracts. There's so many good YU Kollel boys who remain in Israel, need Parnassah. They're the greatest machanchen in the world. Okay, Riskin has them. So it's a different story here. Now, Binyamin Bach, his father, published this volume of Chidushei Torah, other things. In there, he has an entire, it's called The Memory of His Son, Maskeret Pinchas. In there, he has an entire concept of divorce written out in English, what to say, how to explain it. So he evidently had this all prepared. Again, this is not davening. You understand davening, there's an expression, min daven dap dashrei. You know what I'm saying? Did your Rebbe, or min daven dap tilim. You understand? You read the Gemara too quickly, the Rebbe used to choke you. You understand? You got it over the head. You're going too quickly. You have to speed. You have to pause. You have to understand. Ashrei, the same thing. The Megillah is an open Mishnah. It's an open Mishnah. A Megillah. Lo azit she shama shurit yatsa. People come to shul in Georgia, in Atlanta, Georgia, to hear the Megillah. No, I'll give you how many? Give me a nickel for all of those that don't understand Hebrew that are listening. But they're listening. Are they yotzei? Absolutely. It's an open. But here, it's not a question of hearing the holy sacred tongue, the holy Hebrew word. Here, it's a question of Gemirat Dad. A question of Gemirat Dad. You have to know what's going on. So he says you have to read it to them. And then after he reads it, you read it in Hebrew, and he reads it in English, he signs the Edom sign, the Rav HaMasadel, Zichron Devarim, like I explained to you, or if he only has one Eder Chad Kasher, then he has to be together. And he says it would be very good if on the spot, the Rav should have a Beitin there to do a Kiyum of the Shtar. On the spot, immediately. This is so intelligent, you have no idea. When I was Masada Kedushin for Zev Itzkowitz, they did the prenuptial, so my student, Rabbi Jay Shulson, is there. So I couldn't believe that Jay is not only a lawyer. I know he's a lawyer, I know he's an undertaker, I know he's a sportsman, I know he's a hunter. I don't know, he's also a notary public. On the spot, he notarized it. You understand, before the Chatan V'Kala, under the Chuppah, they had a prenuptial, they had a ketuvah, they had tanaim that were worthless, they had a notary public already, nothing gets lost. The worst thing is, because marriage is helter-skelter, it comes, it goes, you plan so many months, second, flat, it's over, you barely have time to say hello, and then you're overwhelmed. After you're married, you have to set up house, and marriage, and responsibility, and adjustment, you can forget about it. And without the Kiyum Shtar, it's worthless. So he says, I'll tell you, with such chachma, you should have a beitin there. I wonder how a rabbanim can have batei dinah. But I guess what he meant is the rabbi brings a shamish, brings a sheichet in those days. See again, you're missing the world in which he lived, in which I lived. You don't understand something today. Today you guys never saw a sheichet in your life. Today chickens come in the supermarket. They're born in the supermarket. Like a kid of 9, he says, Daddy, Papa, how do we get a baby? We buy him in a special supermarket, and the kid believes the father. In those days, that we knew differently. Chickens, you went to the chicken market, the sheikhtim were all over the place. There wasn't a shul without a sheikh or two hanging around. The Bronx was filled with sheikhtim. Philadelphia was filled with sheikhtim. Now what do you call it? Give me the halachic term. Why was there so much opposition to empire poultry when it began in the 50s? Why was it put into chayram? Shchutei chutz. Was the end of Shechita. Philadelphia wouldn't allow it in. There were hundreds of sheikhim that stood to lose their jobs. Today you never saw a sheikhim in your life. Sheikhim have their own shul in Hendata, Pennsylvania, their own minion, their own this, their own that, their own airplane. The only time you knew about sheikhim was low later when that car crash, remember? And what was it? 3 or 4 sheikhim were killed in a horrible car crash. I heard there was sheikhim mumchim. Where did you ever see a sheikhim bodeg today? They're all in Hendata, Pennsylvania, hiding from sight. But in those days, in every shul, there was a shamus. Besides a shamus, there was a sheikh or two. So with these type of Jews, you formed the beitin. The Rav did the lashon of the Kiyum Shtaris, and the beitin signed. Fine. Okay. Very, very fascinating. Now, why can you do this? And here, he cites the Gemara, it's an open Mishnah in Gittin, Perek Bet, Mishnah Hey, Ha'isha Kotevet Et Kita. And all the Mefarshim say, B'tziva LaBala. In other words, the woman, she's a Bakritot. She's involved. V'yatza V'itali Isha Cher. She's one half the marriage. She is involved. This is chayav b'davar. Call it what you wish. It's an open Mishnah. And he brings down the Mishnah. And he says that a woman technically can learn how to write. If she can't learn how to write, so then she can empower others. Now, there's one problem here that he deals with. It's a major, major problem. And he gets us involved in that whole question I showed you with being mezaka the Baal with the get. Remember, I showed you the shaila, the right volume, liftot machake get. It's only one problem. When is she going to write this get? She's going to write this get years later. It can be a year, two, three, four, five, 10, 20. It's not bishat ma'asa. It's months later or years later. Now, who has to own the get? Who has to give who? Let's talk about the ring. Who has to own the ring? Who has to own the ring? What has the Masada Kedushin asked you? Is it your ring? Did you buy it? Do you know that there was a whole shaila in Israel? A guy bought a ring with a credit card. And the credit card, whatever the reasons were, did not deduct for that month. The bill did not come in. It rarely happens, but it happens. I don't know. Today it seems everything is hooked in automatically. That the minute they wave your card, I don't know the way it works, but it's... I know I have bought things on the first day of the month, and I'm billed on the second. One day later, I'm billed. That's amazing to me. But this guy, it just happened now in Israel. The chief rabbi was involved. And the guy, who did the ring belong to? The credit company? The person that sold it? The guy that bought it? He never paid for the ring. Interesting, Shiloh. You have to own the ring. You have to give her something. The same thing with the get. You are giving her the get. Fiyatza v'haita has to be a mirror image. The Havaya and the Yitzia have to be the same. The Baal has to own the get. He is giving the get to the woman. How does she give him the get? 20, 30 years later, it is a real problem. So he approaches it, Zachin li Adam, shelo b'fanav. That since already the Baal made a shliach laholacha, the shliach will be kona the get for the Baal. She writes the get. She's authorized to write the get. She's involved with chuppah v'kedushin. She has the right to write the get. She has the right to bring the get to the shliach laholacha. And at that moment, the shliach is kona for the Baal. And zachin li Adam shelo b'fanav. Even if the Baal's not there, but since he gave permission, it is a schut. It's not a simple problem. I know what you want. It's not a simple problem. I will only... Well, I'll open the difficult question in 1 second, but I just want to say, if this is what you wanted to say, I will only be malamed. And he doesn't mention it here, but I'll tell you what I will be malamed schut. Is the Rambam that we spoke about in Hilchot Gerushin. Remember, we spoke about this Rambam on Tuesday. That since you're allowed, in a different context, but the Rev quoted the Rambam, since you're allowed to beat the hell out of the guy, once you're allowed to beat the hell out of a guy to give a get, and after all, a get has to be miratzon. It's the Rambam, Hilchot Gerushin, Perik Bet, Halacha Chaf. And the Rambam, the get has to be miratzon. So I mean, this is, it doesn't make sense. You're beating the hell out of the guy. He's like a kid. Kid didn't do his homework, so the teacher punishes him. So the kid says, I'll do it now. And suddenly the kid is toeing the mark. He's toeing the mark because he's frightened out of his wits because of the teacher or because of a parent, you understand? You're not going to get a toy. You know the way we threaten kids, which is, by the way, a bad way to bring up kids. But if you ever threaten a kid, you don't threaten him. You have to punish him on the spot. You know, don't say to the kid, blah, blah, blah. Right on the spot, you got to punish him. But don't let it hang over his head. It's not good that way. So the Rambam says, V'yitzro husha takfo v'kim shukad shetashash yitzro v'yomer rotzani kva geiresh liritzono. And it's the famous Rambam that everyone wants to be makayim, divrei chachamim, etc. So that Rambam would help me understand his proposal. That even though the guy is shouting and screaming right now, and he's a mumz and he wants to keep her in a gunna, and he's cursing her out that she should have an epileptic attack under the chuppah when she takes her eldest daughter to marry her off, and you and your daughters, you know, well, listen, Yiddish curses, the Yiddish language is probably the richest language in the world when it comes to cursing, to maledictions. So, but it's a schut. Kofun al-tot, yom ha-rotzani. Zochen liadam shelo b'fanam. That's his proposal to solve that problem. And he's going to be attacked on it, but look, he's saying something you can't take away to Rambam in Hilchot Gerushin. Yes, Elisha. First of all, the get doesn't exist yet. All this is non-existent. To be that she's going to be kind of the peyah, but the thing is this, it has to be written, has to exist. And at that point, the Baal can give it. He has to own the niyar. He has to own the dio. He has to. You saw. So say the, I don't know. It's a zechia, so she should be kind of it instead of. But nevertheless, it has to go with zechia. Whatever you're going to say. That's what he says. That since he made the shliach for the shliach laholacha, you understand. So that shliach should be kind of from. I don't know. You may be right. All I can tell you is in a baiton, if you ever saw the way they give a get, you give the Baal the paper and the yo, and he makes a kinyan before, and he makes a kinyan when it's all finished. So here he's not there. You may be right. That's the solution he gives. Maybe your solution is good too. He doesn't give it. He gives the solution that he mentions here. Okay. All right. No, he doesn't give you a solution. Okay. Now, let me just make one more point today. It's just amazing. I mean, this is with Lundis, with any concern, and Derech Eretz. He makes one more point. He says, why do I pick a specific Beitin? Why did I pick a specific Beitin? This part of the Tshuva is so funny. It's so American. Again, it's maybe true today. It certainly was true then. He says, I'm worried about one thing. The Migda Milta. It's very simple. In America, lo aleinu, you had reverends who styled themselves as rabbis, ignoramuses, boors. You're going to leave it helter-skelter? There's no solution. In addition, money. Lo aleinu. What people will do for money defies imagination. I visited one of the elder Rabbanim in Newark yet on his deathbed, Rabbi Louis Weller. And he said to me on his deathbed, this was the Rav of the Brisker Shul, the Big Machshe. He said to me on his deathbed in Yiddish, I'm translating, he says, you're a young man, yet don't let America destroy you like it destroyed me. At his funeral, Rabbi Isaac Siegel of Jersey City, who was then over 100 years old, at least that's what it was rumored. He died, I think, at 104. Rabbi Isaac Siegel, the whole mafia was then, all the Italians and all the cattle dealers, and at the funeral, and they all spoke Yiddish. Got to understand, all the Italians spoke Yiddish, all the Schwarzes spoke Yiddish. It was a different world then. Do you know that? How do you know that? What was his name? The chief of staff, Colin Powell, speaks Yiddish better than anyone in this room outside of myself. It's unbelievable. What? Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo speaks Yiddish. You grew up among Jews. You spoke Yiddish. Avada. I speak a little Italian. I grew up among Italians. So at the funeral, I'll never forget, he praises Rabbi Weller and says, this is the mid-60s. He's praising him that I could give the man $1 million without witnesses and trust them with it. This was the praise one rabbi was paying to another. So you understand, you could buy Gittin in America, you could buy Kedushin, you could buy anything. Anything was available for sale. I don't know what the situation is today. All I know is that even in America today, you have certain hechsherim are as phony as a 3-cent piece. As a 2-cent piece. You have the tablet K in New York. That's my classmate. This, I mean, your hair can stand on edge. Stories. Nothing. Taking money. So that's what he's worried about. And then he says, which bacon should it be? And he says, I leave this to Rabbanim in every area to decide. Maybe the Agudat HaRabbanim, look what he's saying here, conservative rabbi, maybe the Agudat Rabbanim should make Batei Dinim in 5 or 6 places across America, centrally located. He says in Europe, where the rabbinate is much more organized than in America, you can designate the Beit Din of a certain city. For instance, you'll take England, you take the chief rabbinate's Beit Din in London. Okay? And he says, when I spoke to Rav Kook about this topic, Rav Kook said to me that the only Beit Din that should handle this is the Beit Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. And he says, maybe Rav Kook is the best concept that it should only be in Yerushalayim, because these will be the greatest scholars and they'll be medagdek that everything is done kedat v'kedin. So this was his proposal. So I reiterate, it's mind-boggling. This is a conservative rabbi, but I cannot say a conservative as you understand the concept today. This is a conservative rabbi who today would be affiliated with the traditional conservative movement, whatever it's called, the movement for traditional Judaism, which has a Beit Medrash. I don't know how successful, I understand they're not. But they have a Beit Medrash that they say we function strictly according to halacha. I just read some of their literature, I love it. But we are on the cutting edge of the halacha. That's like a new term today. They introduced an Av Beitin from Tel Aviv at YU. I read in commentator, introduced him. He is on the cutting edge of the halacha. All right, I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But that's the term. We are committed to the halacha. We're on the cutting edge of the halacha. That's the way I would describe Rabbi Louis Epstein. It is an interesting sociological phenomenon. The shul, the man, Eretz Yisrael, Rav Kook, the proposal, the ingeniousness of the proposal, how he goes one step beyond Rav Alkali, one step beyond Rav Henkin, and he brings it together that the woman is the one to write the get. And this solves the heart of the problem of smichatat, who's she going to hear it from, mili, it solves the heart of the problem, because by definition, It's almost as farcical, but by definition, only a living woman needs a get. As long as she's alive, she'll need a get. The minute she's dead, there's no need for a get. Dead people do not a get need from the woman's point of view. Not when the man is dead. When the man is dead, the woman needs a get desperately to avoid chlitza. You follow me? It's a bit of a paradox here. But when the woman is dead, what does she need to get? Problem solved. This is his proposal. Ties in Rabbi Kook. Be'ezrat Hashem, we have to see what happens. Now, just listen to me very, very carefully. I am here, Be'ezrat Hashem, Yitbarach, Tuesday. Wouldn't miss Tuesday for anything. The Rav.